All right, the first case on our calendar today is A23-1017. We are recording the oral arguments here today, and for purposes of the recording, today is February 14th, 2024. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Going back to the case, I guess I didn't give the name of the case. So A23-1017, Bill Kreger versus City of Cambridge. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, so feel free to move that if need be. There's also a clock on the podium that shows how much time you have remaining in your argument. Appellant, when you're ready, you can proceed. And if you would introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would greatly appreciate that.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Jeff Sheik. I represent Bill Kreger in this matter. This case starts on January 4th, 2021, when Mr. Kreger started his employment with the City of Cambridge. He did report an incident that occurred on April 13th, 2021, and that's our addendum starts at 18, and basically there he stated that one of the other employees was smoking in a vehicle on city grounds during city hours. And it's our position that that's a report. The district court did note that they did not consider that to be a report, so there was no prima facie case in under that case.
Counsel, just to clarify, when you said he reported an incident, what specific evidence are you referring to in terms of the report?
Sure, so that's our addendum 18. So those are the notes taken by the supervisor Mills. And basically he says, for an incident with Dan Clausen and Bill shared that Dan got into the truck and tried to light up a cigarette. And so there was an investigation done as a result of it. I would admit that initially it was brought forward by another employee, but that employee brought it forward because Mr. Kreger brought it forward to him. Again, Mr. Kreger is a relatively new employee, and any employee, no matter if they have a lot of seniority or not, they're going to be concerned about bringing it to the attention of management any potential issues because they're afraid of retaliation. And I'd encourage the court to treat even a probationary employee the same as any other employee. It shouldn't matter if you're a probationary employee. You know, you can make the argument that they should have, you know, just the same amount of rights. And that, you know, they're in a new environment, and if they want to report something that they deem to be illegal that may have been going on within the city for years, they should be allowed to do that, and it shouldn't matter that that person's on probation.
Did Mr. Mills also receive notice of the incident from another employee as well?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was some other instances where there's some facts in dispute as to how it was reported, but there's some evidence that there was another employee that reported it as well. But I mean, it would not have happened if Mr. Kreger would not have complained to another employee who brought it forward. And then within a couple of days, I think within 24 hours, Mills did have contact with Mr. Kreger and sat him down and discussed it, and he told him what happened, and then as a result he made some notes of it.
So you're not arguing that this note reflects that Mr. Kreger went to Mills?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. But no. He told another employee about the smoking incident.
Right. And
is it your position that that's the reason that he was discharged?
Correct. Partially because of that and the workers' comp that he filed later on in the lawsuit.
And in the workers' comp, he never received any benefits. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor, that's correct. I would say that the statute does say that whether or not a plaintiff is or a potential client or a workers' comp person is seeking unemployment compensation. And there's some case law indicating
workers'
that.
Workers' comp, right?
Workers' comp.
Yeah, I think you said unemployment.
I'm sorry, workers' comp. I apologize. Yeah. In this case, kind of what the courts were concerned about is I think it was in the Walmart case where they said they're concerned about people being terminated right away, and then that'd be kind of like rewarding the employer and basically saying we're going to fire that person right away before they even get the chance to file for the workers' comp. And so, I mean, I think it would be difficult for an employee to go forward on that basis, and so they should be protected under the Workers' Comp Act.
There were other reasons stated for the termination, though, were there not?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's our position that Mills, who he did not do this on any other employee, and the first time that he started taking notes was April 13th. And I know there's documentation in, stating, I think it's March 16th in the notes that he says, but he indicated in his deposition that he only started taking those on April 13th as a result of the report by Mr. Krieger. And I did ask numerous times management, did he report it? Did he report it?
I mean, that what you said is that Mills stated in his deposition that he started taking notes because of Krieger's report. Is that actually what he said? What did he actually say in his deposition?
I believe I asked him whether or not the March 16th, 2021, was that the first time he started taking notes? And he said, I believe, no, it was actually started on April 13th, and he went back and made the notes relating to March 16th, and then he made it.
Okay, but he didn't testify in his deposition that it's because Krieger made a comment about this coworker smoking in a city vehicle.
I believe you can certainly look.
You can believe, but you know it's a factual question.
The record in our brief that we submitted to the district court, if you look at that section of the brief, I asked him, "Did you make this report as a result of Mr. Krieger?" And I believe he says yes. He could have corrected me and said no.
Okay.
And he says,
"No, no." Well, that I just wanted to clarify.
No problem.
One other thing is in your brief, you make an argument about certain evidence should not have been considered by the district court because it was not in his personnel file. So could you clarify that for me? What wasn't in his personnel file? Why was it improper? It wasn't clear to me from the
briefing. Sure, no problem. So basically his personnel file didn't have very much in it, but it did not have the notes that were taken by Mills, which is in the addendum 18, 19, and 20, which kind of outlines some of the alleged misconduct by Mr. Krieger. And so basically those are the reasons.
Is that required to be in the personnel file, a supervisor's notes?
No, I don't believe it is, but if they're not going to put, I don't think there's anything that's absolutely required under the law to be in the personnel file. I don't think there's anything in there that says you have to have anything in there, but whether or not you put it in there or not, then whether or not somebody can use it against you later on is what we're challenging.
Okay, all right. I understand your argument then. Thanks. Okay.
Going back to the smoking incident, Mr. Valinga, I think that was an employee, other employee's name, had some prior incidents with the employee who was smoking. Is that also accurate?
I would say yes, that's accurate.
And so it was really Mr. Valinga who got the ball rolling on the complaint about the smoking. Is that also accurate?
I mean, I would say that what got the ball rolling is Mr. Krieger complaining to Mr. Valinga, and then Mr. Valinga brought it to Mills' attention, and then it's our position that he conducted an investigation based off of that. And the city does not dispute that we brought a complaint, that under the Minnesota Clean Air Act, they don't dispute that at all, that's a violation of the law. So there's no, and so I think that they conducted a full-on investigation. They interviewed Mr. Krieger, and he gave a statement, and I think the law should protect the person who's being interviewed as part of any type of investigation relating to a violation of the Whistleblower Act.
But you're assuming that that was a reason for his termination, and I'm trying to make the connection between that and the termination. What was it about his reporting that made it, makes the connection between his termination and the smoking incident?
Sure, so I know the courts look at timing, but also, the fact that in the later on during the, which we deem very vague and not specific as to the allegations for termination, they do reference that he did not get along with employees well, but that's probably not illegal. But if it's based off of of the Minnesota Clean Air Act, then it's our position that it is illegal. You know, there's been some discussion in the Hansen case about the sexual harassment, if there's some type of sexual harassment or just general bullying. General bullying, I don't think, is protected conduct under the law.
In terms of the timing, though, the report about the smoking was in April, right?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
And he wasn't terminated until October.
So that's correct. So we do have about a 4.5 month delay before the termination, but I would note that courts have held that within 6 months of the protected conduct being reported and the termination, that was sufficient to get past summary judgment anyways. And I know Kenna also is you know, an important case. It basically said the Supreme Court cautioned courts against usurping the role of the jury when evaluating a claim of summary judgment. So, you know, I think the court should allow us to at least try this in front of a jury, and if the jury doesn't believe my client, then they can rule in favor of the city. I don't think there's little harm going forward as far as trying this in front of a jury. I mean, ultimately as well, the defendant has, the city has lots of rights to try and bring a motion to dismiss, even after we close our case as well, and that's generally done anyways. Just to go on the timing of events, I would just like the court to know that on October 1st, that's when he filed for workers' comp. That's not really in dispute that the management knew about it. And then shortly thereafter, I think it's within like 10 days. You know, October 1st was a Friday. And then there's some discussion that on October 5th, Mills was kind of agitated with my client. It was short with him. And then shortly thereafter, he was terminated. So the Mills deficiency letters is the last entry is June of 2021. So then you have July, August, September, and October, where basically there's no alleged conduct. And the only thing that happened during that time is that he filed for workers' comp, that he sought workers' comp or filed for workers' comp. So that's...
Did he actually file for workers' comp, or did he just file a first report of injury?
It's just the first report of injury, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
He did have a swollen leg, but he never actually filed for it. But he was terminated very, very shortly thereafter. So at least for summary judgment purposes, and when you view the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Krieger, it's our position that that should be a decision that should be made by the jury. All right. So does the court have any other questions about that? Okay, I just reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jessica Shui. I represent the city of Cambridge in this matter. We are seeking and asking that this court affirm the judgment of the lower court below. I'm going to start with the Minnesota Whistleblower Act claim that was dismissed on one portion of the McDonnell Douglas test that no protected report was made. As set forth in our briefing, we've argued to this court that this court can also affirm the decision on alternate basis. There was lack of causation, lack of pretext. And I'll start with the report. There's been some questions about the report. I do want to confirm that in this instance, Mr. Krieger was riding in the vehicle with Dan Collision, alleges that he observed smoking, leaves that vehicle, and the evidence before this court is that he effectively engaged in gossiping at that point, as the way it was perceived by the employer and other complaining employees. He went to a lunch table, says to employees, not supervisors, Dan was smoking in the vehicle. Mr. Valengo was present. Yes, he had a history with the smoking individual. They leave that location, go to the location where Mr. Collision is supposed to be present. He's not there. And they start a conversation with yet another employee. Mr. Collision learns about these events occurring, and he's the first one to bring it to the attention of the supervisor, Mr. Mills, and says, I'm being gossiped about. It's a false allegation. I don't like it. I want you to do something about it. That's what the complaint was. And then it was Mr. Mills' meeting with Mr. Krieger after that point in time to address effectively the gossiping in the workplace, and it suggested that that's where a report was made.
Oh, go ahead. You're characterizing this as gossiping, but on some summary judgment, we look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Yes, but this record would support the notion that Dan Collision went to Mills saying he's spreading false rumors about me. And so I could say it that way instead of gossiping.
In appellant's brief at page 50 to 51, they cite part of the testimony or deposition testimony, I believe. The question was, do you at least admit that there was a smoking incident reported to you via Mr. Krieger at some point in time? And Mills says yes.
Yes.
Isn't that testimony sufficient to create at least a genuine issue of material fact as to a report?
No. And here's why. If you look at the collective testimony of Mills, Schwab, and Vogel, they're all clear as they're being asked the questions in the deposition. We will agree to refer to this as a smoking incident. We won't agree with you that a report was made. That's one. I'm just going to use that as the factual basis. Okay. Then I'm going to back it up and bring it out to the law. Appellant has suggested that in Freelander, it eliminated this court's jurisdiction and authority to review how is a report made and what's the nature of that. As we set forth in our brief, I don't believe that Freelander eliminated the court's jurisdiction in that regard and in conjunction with the statute. Instead, the question still is, did the employee that's seeking a protected status make a report? And we look at the facts underlying that and say, did this employee go to an employer, which is represented through the managerial staff, and say, I believe blah, 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 whatever it is, X, Y, Z, constituted a violation of the law. In this instance, I believe.
Do you actually have to say it constituted a violation of the law for it to be a report?
It has to sufficiently implicate, right? So to use the language from Sackerson versus City of Gilbert, one of the cases we cited from this, so that was somewhat similar to the situation. What do they actually say? It had to be sufficient to implicate a violation of the law. That's not how this came to Mills' attention. The way it came to his attention first was Collision saying, this guy is spreading false rumors about me, that I was smoking in a vehicle. Mills then meets with Krieger. There's no dispute. He meets with Krieger. And that Krieger says something to the effect of he was smoking in the vehicle and it's unlawful to do so. I have to acknowledge that's the case. But it doesn't eliminate the concept from Freelander and Sackerson and the other cases issued since Freelander that what was the purpose and intent of the employee that's seeking the protected status. Krieger here wasn't going to make the report. He didn't make the report to an individual. With that, Your Honors, I'll move on to there's a question on timing. So this smoking incident occurred in April. As indicated, the termination decision is not made until October. If the court has already referenced deposition testimony, I'm sure the court's familiar with the fact that the city staff couldn't recall exactly when they met to discuss the termination decision. There had been a series of meetings or conversations beginning in late August 2021 through September.
We're familiar with the record.
Okay.
So on the issue of there being a causal connection, so conflict between Krieger and his coworkers was one of the reasons, stated reasons, correct?
Correct.
And then there is testimony quoted in appellant's brief that conflict started based on Krieger's comment about this employee smoking in a vehicle when he shouldn't have been. So why does that not create a causal connection, that testimony? I mean, that's one of the reasons for termination.
Yes. So as the court's case law says, timing alone does not establish a causal connection. So that's one component of it. Another component of it would be the issue of the smoking incident did not continue to be discussed in the workplace. Instead, we can see from the notes there continued to be performance issues. We get to the performance evaluation that was at the end of July, continued to be a performance issues there. And this is a probationary employee that just isn't working out. That's the best explanation I can give to Your Honor on that. In our opinion, it's consistent with case law. That's still sufficient to break the causal connection. We have evidence of continuing performance issues starting prior to the alleged report, continuing after, documented. Mr. Krager, in his own admissions during testimony, validated some of the performance issues that were occurring and that were one of some of the reasons. Other employees also gave testimony on these performance issues did occur, and we went through the incidences. And so really the challenge became to, and is still the challenge now, were any one of those performance issues that were raised sufficient in totality to lead to the termination decision, or was it really pretext? And as the court properly recognized below, and it was best reflected in Mr. Schwab's testimony, it's the cumulative nature of each of the performance issues that came up. And the case law would say we're still looking on a pretext analysis. Is there a sufficient quantum of evidence to say that the moving reason for termination was retaliatory animus? You're on a mixed motive. Even if we took the one string, one thread of the employees are not getting along and that came out of the April incident, that is only one strand of the analysis. The rest of the evidence is, and the quantum of the evidence that the court looks at is, there's documented performance issues, there's admitted the confirmation by the plaintiff that they engaged in that. We look for retaliatory remarks. This record is completely devoid of retaliatory remarks. And prepping for the oral argument this morning, I was reminded that it was consistently asked and confirmed that when Mr. Krager was presented with the notice of intent to terminate on October 26th, that he was dumbfounded. He was dumbfounded. He had no concern of being retaliated against because of the smoking incident. Time had passed. No one was bringing it up. He had no concern that he was being terminated for a first report of injury. It had been filed. He had had a response from the League of Minnesota Cities, the workers' compensation. He wasn't seeking medical leave. He had no reason to believe that he was being terminated for those items. He was terminated using the mixed motive analysis, again, for the performance. And that performance is validated by, and then the court gets into the issue of comparator evidence. And there's a discussion about, does Mr. Krager meet the comparative evidence analysis? There's a recognition that other employees had been engaged in equally minor performance issues and not necessarily and certainly never terminated. As the court recognized, they weren't great comparators because they're union employees. Mr. Krager was still on a probationary status. A different level applies then when measuring whether there's just cause for termination or not, and a different body of law becomes applicable there. So they're not appropriate comparators. Where it also become the comparator analysis was relevant, and the court said, to the extent I'm going to look at those other employees, I'm going to recognize that there's other employees who have filed first reports of injury, and yet they remain employed. And not only have they filed first reports of injury.
Were they probationary employees, though?
And they were not, right? And that's the tricky part about the comparator evidence here, because Mr. Krager is pointing towards the union employees, and we would suggest that they're not comparable. Because of the union status does have a significant impact to that.
What standard do you think the city has to make to show is it just cause for termination or what?
For a union employee, the contract would apply, yes. For a probationary employee, not. And I will say,
could you clarify that? You said under the union contract for a probationary employee, it isn't just cause, it's what?
Correct. Probationary employees are at will. So at will being for any reason not unlawful.
And that's under the union contract?
It wouldn't, probably is not stated in the union contract that way. In the union contract, typically it's written to say you become a union employee upon successful completion of probation. And at that time, the terms of the contract are XYZ, and there's usually a just cause termination provision.
So are you saying you didn't need any reason to terminate him?
Correct. We did not need any reason. I will recognize something that opposing counsel argued because it came up in response to one of your questions, Your Honor. Should there be differential treatment of probationary employees? In our brief, the city's brief, we cited the court to a number of unpublished cases, and I'm sure there was some quizzical, why am I citing to so many unpublished cases? The majority of cases addressing probationary employee status and the application of laws such as the work comp retaliation or the whistleblower arise in unpublished cases. But they're consistent in those cases is the recognition of this. In Minnesota, we are an at-will termination state. You can be terminated for any reason, not unlawful, unless you're a union employee and you have these additional provisions, right? Or if we create a contract. I can give you exceptions, but it's generally agreed here. Mr. Krager terminated any reason, not unlawful. The same body of unpublished case law that we cited the court to is relevant here because there's a suggestion that the documentation related to Mr. Krager was weak and basically that it was unfair because it was never presented to him. The Minnesota Court of Appeals cases, if you read through all of them, they talk about this notion. When you're a probationary employee, it's a short duration of employment, so it's certainly understandable that an employer is not going to have a significant quantum of documentation related to the poor performance that it's observing. So the court should take recognition of that. The other thing that the court should take recognition of in a probationary situation is that there is a limited window of time that you're working with. And so the causal connection is always that factor there because you're working with mere months.
But if it would be unlawful if it was a whistleblower complaint or if it was because he had filed an unemployment claim, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. With that, my time has expired, Your Honors. Unless there's any further questions, I simply ask that this court reaffirm. All right, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Five minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address the Freelander decision that was from 2017. And it basically said that the definitions set forward by the legislature are controlling to the court. So we've talked about what's to report, who to report. The good faith definition does not say you have to report it to so-and-so. You have to report it directly to management. You know, it does involve a co-employee. It doesn't say anything like that. What it does say is, and good faith is defined under 181.932 subdivision 3, this section does not permit an employee to make statements or disclosures knowing that they are false. There's no evidence whatsoever anywhere in the record that Mr. Krieger made the statements to Miles in a false way or they are in a reckless disregard of the truth. There's no evidence as well stating that he reported that or was in the investigation or during the investigation phase that he said anything that was in reckless disregard for the truth. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary. The Mills stated that he thought he filed it in good faith and other employees thought that he filed things in good faith and there was no ill will involved here. So I think that the Freelander decision is important and I know...
I didn't read the city's brief as challenging whether he was acting in good faith. It was about whether he made the report, and I think we probably heard enough about whether it was or wasn't a report.
Okay.
One question about the incident report. Looking at addendum 18, and it says that Mr. Krieger said that Mr. Collison never did smoke in the vehicle.
But he was going to light up. It says something to the effect of...
He was going to, but he didn't. He stopped before he violated the law, right?
Yep, so but it was a suspected violation or violation of the law if he was going to smoke.
Does it make a difference that he didn't actually smoke?
I don't believe it does, because all that is required under the law, and I think this is important, I think this is where courts sometimes get it wrong in the district court, is you go to the definition of false disclosure. So what is that? What is that? How is that defined? And the court stated in Freelander, it eliminated the judicially created requirement that the Whistleblower Act with purposes of exposing illegality. So there's no... Like, maybe the term whistleblower is not appropriate. There's no requirement that they have to actually blow the whistle. All that's required is to go to the definition section and say, did the person who was reporting the conduct, did they act in a false manner or in a reckless disregard? And it's a very, very, very broad definition section, and it's very, very favorable to the employee because the legislature, in my opinion, wanted employees to... report incidences and to have a broad effect, so they know that, generally speaking, an employee's not going to walk into their management and say, hey, they violated the Minnesota Clean Air Act, Minnesota Section 142.1441. It's just not going to happen. I mean, even attorneys in this case had to look up and see what exactly the statute was relating to the Minnesota Clean Air Act. But, I mean, those questions were asked, and the city did concede that was reported conduct. And the more important question is the manner in which they did it. That's what they're challenging, I would say. And then, you know, I would ask the court to kind of look at the reasons for termination. They're minor. Mr. Krieger was surprised, dumbfounded. Even Vogel, the person who ultimately brought Mr. Krieger into the office and fired him, he said yes, he was generally surprised. Mr. Krieger called him on his cell phone or at work and left him a message basically saying, hey, I don't know what happened here. Why, I don't know why I was terminated. I'd like you to get my side of the story. I mean, there's basically 3 months of no issues as far as employment misconduct. So he was surprised by that. And that there's a July 6th write-up or performance review, of Mr. Krieger. But he never received that. I mean, and other employees, I think it was Lindquist stated, and who was also a probationary employee during or around the same time as Mr. Krieger, stated that they brought him in and discussed it with him and said yes, and he had about a 40-minute conversation with management as far as that is concerned. So they also treated him differently that way. There is no evidence. They admitted it in their deposition testimony that they never brought him in and said, hey, we don't think you're doing okay on this specific subject or this specific subject. So how would Mr. Krieger know what type of conduct to try and you know to try and improve upon if he doesn't really know what the issues are?
And you can answer this question.
Sure.
What is your best argument that the evidence shows that the reasons given were a pretext?
Basically that they're very trivial and not supported by anything. I mean, if you look at the other employees, obviously the management's going to support their own accusations. But if you look at other employee evidence, I asked them, you know, is taking a tool cat across the field, is that a big deal? And they all say no. It's all no. There's nobody says, yes, there's a major violation here. And in fact, one of the comments was that he didn't have a good work ethic. I asked other employees. They said, no, he thought he had a great work ethic. And they specifically named, I think it was Ratty, who said, you know, Ratty's have said that he didn't have a good work ethic. I deposed Ratty, and I said, did you ever say that to Mr. Mills? And he said, no. So there's genuine issues of material fact. And then when you view those evidence in light most favorable to Mr. Krieger, we're asking that the court reverse the summary judgment and let it go to jury trial. I'll ask. Is that?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today. They're very helpful. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.